Well, first, I would like to give my heartless thanks to the organizers for inviting me to come to KITP. When I die, and if there is a paradise, I want it to be here. On this note, this talk is... right. Well, that's the part that's maybe purgatory, let's say. So I'd like to acknowledge the many people who have participated in several discussions that will be representing their work. They are here. And also funding from NASA and, of course, the KITP for this stay and the International Fine Particle Research Institute. Okay, so I would like to talk about essentially three kinds of flows, with and without sidewalls. So these are the ones without sidewalls. The simulations were carried out by Nicolas Taberlé at the University of Rennes, and they are similar in many respects to the ones that Leo Silbert and co-workers have carried out. What you see here is is two flows, one that is on a on a bumpy frictional base, which resembles what was talked about earlier today. This scale here shows the color scale shows the velocity. For this kind of flow, the mass flow rate is proportional to the 5-second power of the height, which is the so-called Bagnall scaling we just heard about. For these flat frictional flows, the wall is flat and frictional, but you distinguished a much larger velocity that's achieved here. Here it's 5, and there it was 1.5. And the mass flow rate is proportional to the 3/2 power of the height. Okay, and this is a flow that the Ren group showed. They wrote a PRL paper on the subject, to which Jim Jenkins participated. And here you see a yet much larger velocity, but these flows are much more inclined, and they establish themselves on a heap that is in a rotable, that provides an erodible boundary, and there's a gradual increase of the velocity until a free surface, which then develops what I would call a ballistic layer. So these are between flat and frictional walls. They're sandwiched between two walls this time, and the mass flow rate has to be made dimensionless differently than what you saw before. It has to be made dimensionless with the width between the side walls, and it exhibits a linear profile, dependence rather on height, on the flow height. Okay, so I'll like to show these flows one at a time and have some remarks about these flows. There's really no time in 20 minutes to talk about all the things I'd love to talk about, so I've tried to concentrate the remarks on some salient points. So now I'd like to talk about slow, shallow, steady, fully developed flows on a bumpy incline without sidewalls. So it was the flow that is referred to as Bagnall scaling, quote unquote. The word slow is seldom used in describing these, but I think it's important. These, if the flow are considerably more accelerated, they will revert to the flow on the flat frictional wall. This is what's called long run-out landslides in the jargon of geophysics. They also have to be shallow. It has been shown experimentally, but not yet published, that if the height is large enough, then these flows will revert also to a flow that's more applicable to a flat frictional wall. Okay, so this is a picture you've seen before. I distinguished in these flows three layers, and I talked about that earlier in the question. There's a basal layer, which is essentially a boundary layer where the boundary is very important, and there's this core that has a constant volume fraction, at least as far as we can tell from simulations. And also from geometry experiments that were carried out at the University of Rennes. And then there is a surface layer where the flow exhibits a volume fraction that drops sharply to zero at the free surface. So those were seen in experiments by Olivier Pouliquen, famous paper in 1999, and then the seminal paper by Silbert and co-workers who simulated this. Okay, now the one remark that I'd like to talk about is, imagine that I'm adopting a kinetic theory and that I would like to write an energy balance in these flows. And so what would happen is you have three terms in that steady fully developed energy balance. The first has to do with the work of the shear stress, so the velocity gradient. So it has this viscosity that depends, you put your most favorite value of the that could diverge differently depending on theories, various theories on the volume fraction, and it's proportional to the square root of the temperature. And this is equation of state, and you could put your favorite value of this as well here. And then there's a dissipation rate that's proportional to 3 hours power of the temperature, and again the restitution or any other mechanism of dissipation is buried in that function of nu. And then you have the heat flux, the grain of the heat flux, which is given in terms of Fourier's law, and in the kinetic theories is again given in terms of function F2 of the volume fraction, and like the viscosity is proportional to the square root of T. Okay, now I'd like to show that there's a dilemma that arises naturally from this formulation. If I integrate the momentum balance, what I have here is the normal stress that rises from the free surface down, like the pressure in the non-ordinary liquid, fluid, and the same thing goes with the shear stress. Then here's the equation of state, rewritten in appropriate fashion. Because of the increase of the normal stress with depth, the temperature is itself linear in the depth of the free surface. This is the coordinate that is taken to be zero at the free surface and increasing downward and measured relative to the particle diameter. And here's this equation that I showed you earlier, the energy balance, but rewritten. So there's no, it's, this is as exact as what I showed you earlier within the framework of the kinetic theory. Okay, now let's suppose that we adopt that the volume fraction is a constant through the core. And has been said several times today already. What that means is that this term drops out. All these functions of nu come out of the derivative. And let's suppose then that we insist on keeping this term here. The term arises from the gradient of the feed flux. So when one obtains is this equation, okay? And this equation we can identify where these terms come from. This term here comes from the gradient of the flux. This term comes from the work of the shear, and this term is the dissipation. Okay, so what is the dilemma here? The dilemma of this, if we adopt this equation, it's an absurd statement because we started by assuming that volume fraction was a constant, and what this equation tells us is that the volume fraction, which is embodied in these groupings here, will depend not only on the depth, but also on the tangent of an angle of inclination. So there's a bit of a dilemma because of the dependence on this quantity here. Okay, now of course, what a lot of kinetic theories do is they say, okay, we'll ignore the terms and we'll just have this balance, which then provides a prediction of angular limits and which also provides some dependence on the volume fraction, which may or may not be consistent with the experiments, depending on the way that these functions are chosen. And they're often chosen to diverge in peculiar ways so as to make the theory fit the experiment better. Well, that's exactly the point. Yeah, that's exactly the point. We're not solving it as it is. And if we solve it as it is, we could see whether or not the theory has any dependence on the volume fraction on depth. What the various theories will do is have functions that will be chosen so that they don't have an exaggerated dependence on depth. But the point is that if we assume that nu is a constant, then all the kinetic theories will not predict that constancy. They might become close, but they will not predict it.
Have dependences on depth, mm-hmm. You know, so that they exactly cancel, or you can keep them determined that they're themselves eliminated.
Well,
and say there's some very small dependences on depth, but it's a little unsatisfying to have that
Well, F1 and 3 and 4 and these other terms that I erased do not depend on depth, but they only depend on volume fraction, and possibly on restitution.
Right,
that's right. Okay, so what's going on here? I believe that what's going on here is that there's an invariance of conductivity in the core of a flow. If instead I adopt the assumption that many theorists will adopt, that the gradient of the flux is indeed zero, and if I recognize the temperature grows linearly with depth, it means that if I adopt the Fourier law, the dT dy is in fact constant, And if Q is a constant and dTy is a constant, then it follows that the conductivity must be a constant as well. Okay? Which of course contradicts the Fourier's law. But so what we have is we have a number of invariants in the core. S of n is known to be invariant, it's equal to tangent alpha. Nu is invariant given by simulations. Now Q is also invariant, and so is kappa. And so is, by the way, the inertial parameters proposed by GDR-MIDI, which is invariant the core. And so is the parameter that I proposed, this ratio of enduring shear stresses to total shear stresses. I'm not going to talk much about that model that appeared in PRE. But it's also invariant. Now, what is not invariant is the shear rate, the temperature itself, the shear and the normal stresses taken independently, and the dissipation, and the conductivity. It's not invariant. Okay, so an alternative is to assume that the conduction is actually driven by phonons, quote-unquote. And the idea is to, so imagine you have a chain of particles linked by springs and dashpots, and you can recast this in the continuum limit to an equation that depends upon some kind of a speed of sound that depends on the stiffness, and a dissipation rate that depends upon the dashpot, a constant. And you carry out the analysis, and you do that in, so it gives you a complex, if you plug in a wave, it gives you a complex conductivity, the real part of which has to do with the dissipation, and the imaginary part of which has to do with the Fourier conduction. And so it gives a result that looks like that. And it turns out if one plugs in any reasonable values of these parameters, this has to be greater than one for sure. So, and that in itself in practical flows is much greater than Ki. So what I say is that the conductivity is dominated by things that are invariant indeed. And, I'm sorry? In fact, Le is what you propose. And in fact, that's what I learned from Tom Halsey's talk the other day here, where Le is probably equal to, it has to do with the length of a force chain or some kind of characteristic length, which you have defined, in fact, in your article as being this quantity, which is the inverse of the GDR-MIDI parameter, and which I would predict equal to this from the model that I proposed. We can plug in numbers into this, and they make sense. It goes between, say, 10 particle diameters when the flow is almost stopped, down to about 3 parameters when it becomes unsteady and then fully developed and collisional. Okay, so weighing theories. Slow flow on a bumpy base, this is my challenge to theorists. Theorists must predict these things. I believe they must predict that they mobilize through the depth. Now, this might be a kinetic theorist, and this might be people who believe more in force chains. So they have to have an invariant nu in the core, I think, and they have to predict the H-stop that previous speakers talked about. They have to predict this dependence on mass flow rate if the flow is thick enough. They have to predict that it's insensitive to restitution, because that's what Leo Selbert measured. And by the way, the model using phonons and stuff does, in fact, can predict that as well. And they have to predict a range of angular inclinations where flows are steady and fully developed. Okay, now let's move to flows on a frictional plane. They're still slow and shallow first. These are simulations, again, done by Nicolas Tabelli. I just showed you these things earlier. Here's the velocity profile in depth for the flow we just talked about. And here's the one for flat frictional boundaries, which is this one here. What you could see, of course, is the velocity is much greater for a flat frictional boundary. But one thing that's interesting to find out, if you translate this curve up to match the one on the flat frictional boundary, you will see that that the shear rate is the same. So in other words, there exists a core on the flat frictional boundary that has the same shear rate. And it has also the same volume fraction. So in fact, there's not much, it may appear that these flows are very different, but in fact, they share many similarities. And so what happens is that if you are able to accelerate a flow, such as in the experiments of Hunger and Morgenstern that were done many decades ago, and Jim Jenkins, for instance, had advocated that those be looked at carefully before, if you accelerate it fast enough, there's also numerical simulation evidence that was recently done but yet unpublished, it will probably come out soon, that show that this flow can transition into that flow. There's also some unpublished, unfortunately, experiments that show that the food number, while rising linearly with height at first, which is the characteristic of the Bagnall flow, will eventually asymptote to a constant, which is more characteristic of the flat frictional boundary. Okay, so these two flows are connected in some sense. All right, the velocity in a flat frictional boundary, it's relatively easy to show. There's a slow core and a rapid shear layer that could be rather nicely predicted using kinetic theory in some combination I'm not going to go into this, but it's rapid shear layer and a slow core on top. So Jim Jenkins pioneered these calculations, and I did an article on this a few years ago. So the argument is very simple. Here's the shear stress that's constant in the shear layer, and determined by the height of the flow, and this is equal to viscosity times the shear rate. And if you combine that with the equation of state, you can find that indeed the mean velocity goes as h to the 1/2 as advertised, which means that the mass flow rate goes as h to the 3/2. These are typically steeper than the angle on the shallower. I'm sorry, because the flow can originate at lower angles by virtue of its character. And in the long run at landslide, it can be very shallow. Once they get accelerated, these babies don't stop. Okay, Bayer theories, flows on the frictional bottom. I'm sorry for the corny joke. So the flows on the frictional bottom, this is a challenge to theorists. They have a rapid shear layer. They have an invariant nu in the slower core. The mass flow rate must be dependent on 3/2 of the power. They do exhibit traffic waves, which I documented and theorized upon in that paper I just mentioned. And interestingly enough, but I didn't talk about that much today, they also have angular limits, which happen to be comprised between the friction measured in collisions and impacts and the static friction of the same beads on the plate. So that's also the reasons for that, but I'm not going to go into this now. Okay, now, say fully evaporated on an erodible heap with sidewalls. This is the work that was pioneered by the Rehn group, and then also worked on more recently by Poulikin and co-workers. So these are called sidewall stabilized heap. They originally called them super stabilized heap, but they are stabilized by the sidewall, so they have changed the terminology, if you like. So here's I put this flow sideways to show how it corresponds to these coordinates. If I take the coordinate at the free surface, which is exhibited by a very sharp kink in the sharp discontinuity in the velocity profile, and by the way, Jean Reichenbach says that there are some flows that have a linear velocity profile. This is one of them. It has a convex profile, which can be looked at as being a linear profile. So this is typical of flows on boundaries that are dissipative, such as this erodible boundary. So all these things are all compatible in the end. You know, they all. But what's really interesting in here is that the density, so there are three regions: a static layer, the heap, a mobilized layer, and a ballistic layer where literally there are hardly any collisions going on. In fact, it's possible to, I did a calculation with the help of Jim Dufty and Javier Bray last couple of weeks, that actually predicts the form of this. This is like a thermal wall, and the Wurm fraction decays away from it. But anyway, the really interesting thing is that there's an exponential increase, and it's rather remarkable how well it fits an exponential increase of the volume fraction away from the free surface downward that can be fitted by this. Okay, this is the phenomenon. This is Nicolas Taberlé himself doing the experiment. You can see the sidewall stabilized heap is if you then empty out the flow, you could see that the heap is not stable any longer. It doesn't stay. It is being washed out on the underlying bumpy boundary. Okay. The experiments that we carried out at Rennes were done with very, very coarse grain, very sharp angular particles, and very particles that had many different sizes, very poorly dispersed. And it turns out to be important. So we redid their experiments, this time with much more rounded Ottawa sand, nearly monodispersed, and you can see the picture here. So you see the height, and the height is looked at by blurring the picture. So there's some degree of arbitrariness here, but it's not too bad. And we measure the angle. And so the global SSS behavior is that the tangent of the angle of inclination is linear in the height, and also in the mass flow rate, establishing an intercept that we call alpha min here, and another intercept that we call alpha stop, and those two angles are one is greater than the other. There's an effective friction that the flow establishes itself. This is a momentum balance that the Rand group understood in the original PRL paper. They, however, found the value of mu w, which is much greater than the one that we measure here with round sand. What's really remarkable about these flows is that they all scale with w, all the way down to a w over d of 4.5. It's only 4.5 diameters. And we could probably have gone lower if the walls were not separated by 1/8 of an inch, and we just couldn't feed the flow anymore. So there is no... however, these flows exhibit a minimal height that depends on the diameter of the particles. So they all scale as h over w, but the flow, for instance, a much smaller value of the diameter will start higher. And typically, the jamming height is on the order of 10 particle diameter. We could be larger or smaller than w over d. Okay, I'm going to go fast because I see that Kumaran is very nervous. H-stop is very much unlike Poulikin's definition. It just doesn't look at all like that. So the idea of using the same inertial parameter I to capture this is probably not an idea that I would recommend. It's also probably quite anisotropic, because it doesn't behave the same way in the width than it does in the height. Okay, now, friction depth, I'm going to go fast on this one. Actually, maybe I could just ignore it altogether. I just wanted to say that this argument leads to a definition. This is the integration of momentum balances, and here's the equation that I just showed you earlier, except dependent on depth through the flow. And what I just want to show is that the friction at the sidewall cannot be constant, otherwise these integrals would diverge. So that's something to take into account. These are the two challenges. How does the friction at the wall depend on depth, and how does the volume fraction depend on depth? And required predictions. SSS flows, must have an exponential profile of nu, have a convex profile of u, relate n prime tangent alpha and h over d linearly, and should be insensitive to d, except for this thing done as a, that's called HDM. And thank you for your, and special thanks to Norman Rockwell and Coputo Incorporated, the works of which I have shamelessly absconded. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
A little confused because you have slip at the bottom. If you take the slip out and then look at the rest of it, you say that goes back to the standard rough bumpy bottom. So what I'm confused is your m dot equation, because in fact there's two pieces of physics going on. If I make the depth deeper and deeper,
right,
I should have the same amount of slip, and therefore I should go back to the other case.
It's a good question. It's not quite as you described. The boundary has some influence over some sort of kind of a shear layer. So it doesn't immediately come to the core, as you saw.
Right.
Okay. Now that particular simulation was done with simulation parameters that may or may not be realistic in natural flows. We carried out such experiments, and the shear layer was very much thinner than what was shown in these simulations. I just wanted to show the simulations to make the point that there, unlike what was suggested earlier, it's not just an overburden that has zero temperature and it actually has the Bagnall scaling, at least according to the simulations. Now, whether or not the simulation describes the natural flow, it's another question. Okay, but the one height, the h to the 1/2 power, is related to the existence of a thin shear layer.
So for the flat bottom, what range of heights were used to determine that m dot went like h to the 3/2 as opposed to the classical bumpy bottom?
It's actually not
bottom.
It was not very deep. In the experiments we carried out, our height was no bigger than, maybe 10 or 15 particle diameter deep, which, by the way, is not unlike what Olivier Poulikin did in his own experiments, simulations for some obscure reason are able to have much greater heights without breaking down into there's something in the simulation that is.
So how do you determine m dot dependence on h if you only have one height? I guess I'm confused.
No. In the experiments, and you could see it if you looked at the experiment, the shear layer is very thin. It's only a few particle diameters thick. Okay, maybe anywhere from 1 to 2.5 and 3.
But that's not Gary's problem. Gary's problem is that there's some delta v thrust material. You know, if you took a simple frictional theory of going on thrust there's that delta v, you add that delta v, it fits very nicely in the picture. And then you have a Beezer's three hat profile above that. And so the simplest picture, eventually that Beezer's three hat profile starts to dominate.
No, it doesn't. No, because there's so much. No. Because there's slip. Because there's huge slip at the base. In other words, the. Yes, precisely. You could ignore.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I can. If you read the paper that I published in 2001, Physics of Fluids, that explanation is there. But we take a little long to explain right now. But I can sit down with you and show you why. Yes, it is. Yeah, the very simplistic picture that I showed, the simple calculation, is nothing. You know, the physics is much more complicated. It involves slip that has to be predicted, which was not predicted by the simple, this one slide, one liner. It has to involve the actual spin. The spin in the base layer in the shear layer is very important, in fact, crucial to the physics, and so is the friction that individual contact points have with respect to the wall. And that's in fact why the angles of inclination are between these two limiting frictions. So it's actually much more complicated. But I would be more than happy to make a presentation on this if that was of interest, because I have it here.
Yeah, Bill?
Yes. Yes, that's a good question. I think of course, the sidewalls are the ones that are dissipating the momentum in ways that are very different than if sidewalls were not present. Okay, that's the really big on the momentum side. On the energy side, on the granular temperature side, an inwardable boundary is inherently a dissipative boundary, and the dissipative boundary is inherently like the basal layer, what I call the basal layer in the Poulikin-Selbert chute. That inwardable boundary is inherently dissipative and therefore exhibits convex velocity profiles and exhibit temperatures that increase from the boundary. So that's on the energy side, that's really what makes a big difference.
Okay, if there are no further questions, we'll thank our speaker again and then go into the discussion.